Now broadcasting in English.
Hello and welcome to this weekend edition of Radio Prague, the international service of Czech radio. My name's Christian Falvey. Many thanks for tuning in. Starting off an excellent program for today, David Vaughan has A Whole War in a Tin Box in Czech books. After that, Science Journal takes us into the world of quantum computers. And later on in our program, another trip through the Czech radio archives. All that ahead, so please stay tuned. You will probably not have heard of Grossána, Brande, Blechhammer, or Schatzlar, but these are places that should be remembered. They were all Nazi slave labor camps in World War II. The last on that list, Schatzlar, or Žatec, as it is known in Czech, was in what is now the Czech Republic, in the part of northeastern Bohemia annexed by the German Reich in 1938. Few people in this country, even among the inhabitants of Žatec itself, know that the camp even existed, but a new book should help put that right. The daughter of one of the survivors has just been in the Czech Republic to launch the Czech edition of her book Sala's Gift. The book tells her mother's story, drawing richly from Sala's own memories and from several hundred letters that, against all odds, survived the war. David Vaughan tells the story.
Anne Kirchner's mother, Sala, was one of 50,000 young Jewish men and women from southern Poland who were made to work in labor camps as part of Operation Schmelt, an SS division set up after the 1939 invasion. The aim was to provide slave labor for German construction projects and factories. Working conditions were awful, but at least in the camps that Sala went through, prisoners were allowed to wear their own clothes. They were not tattooed with numbers as at Auschwitz, and crucially to this story, they were able to send and receive post. Thanks to Sala's surviving correspondence and her diary entries, the book Sala's Gift gives us a picture of her life as a teenager, passing from one labor camp to another, becoming close friends with some of the other girls. Here is part of a message that the girls wrote to Sala in the camp not long before they were liberated.
March the 5th is a happy and lucky day for us. For today we are celebrating our dear Sala's birthday. Alas, still behind barbed wire. Oh, what a great holiday this would be if we celebrated your birthday in freedom, together with your loved ones. Let's not lose hope. Let good luck shine on you just like the bright sunshine that steals secretly through our camp windows. Sala, sometimes when the three of us are in the bunk and you are asleep, we hear you call in your sleep, Mommy, Daddy. We do not want to wake you, for we know that at that moment you are happily with them. We talk it over. Should we wake her or not? Forgive us, Sala dearest, that we sometimes disturb your sweet dreams.
After 5 years in various slave labor camps, the persistent, gentle humanity of letters like this is striking. Anne had no idea that her mother's letters had survived. With her new life in the United States, Sala would never talk about her experiences of the war, even to her children. That was until 1991, when she was about to go to hospital for major heart surgery. She handed Anne a box, and not surprisingly, Anne assumed that it contained her jewelry.
It's as simple as that. Only what was inside of the box was not jewels, but 350 letters that she had received while she was imprisoned in 7 different Nazi slave labor camps.
And this was in the early 90s, some 50 years after it had all happened.
Yes, she kept that secret for 50 years. When she came to the States, to the United States as a war bride, she had those letters with her, but somehow they got hidden away and we never knew about them.
And what were these letters? These aren't just letters that she wrote, are they? There are all sorts of things in the box.
In fact, almost none of them were written by her. They're written, a lot of them are written by her sister, who was still at home, and so she tells her about the worsening conditions at home. Some of them were written by her dear friend Alla Gärtner, who was later hanged at Auschwitz as a heroine of the resistance. Some of my favorites are the letters that were written to her by her girlfriends, which are just the kinds of letters you would expect 16-year-old silly girls to write, about haircuts and boys and clothing. So here it is, the middle of the war. Jews are being deported and sent to horrible places, and they're talking to her about their haircuts.
Extraordinary, isn't it? This strange normality next to the most grotesque abnormality.
Yes, and I think these are the things that we do when real life is too much for us. We do find it a new kind of normalcy that gives us comfort.
What's particularly unusual about your mother's story is the fact that we hear a lot about the big camps, the extermination camps. She survived the entire war in small camps which most people won't have even heard of.
Obviously, there's been a tremendous amount written about the death camps. These camps, the Zwangarbeitslager, the forced labor camps, there really has been very little written about. I had to do a lot of original research to go back to the German archives to figure out what had happened. Some of the Nazis wanted to kill all the Jews. Some of them wanted to just work them to death. And the network of forced labor camps was really built by Germans who wanted to make money off the Jews as slaves.
And I had never heard of the camp in Jatzlerz, which is a small town in the Krkonoše Mountains in the far north of the Czech Republic. I'd never heard that there was a camp there. And that came as a real surprise to hear that your mother, as a Polish Jew, spent the war working there.
I think it came as a surprise to the people in Jatzlerz now.
And how has the local authority in Jatzlerz reacted? Are they interested? Is there sort of an interest in, for example, having some kind of memorial there?
I haven't heard about a memorial, but I have been invited to meet with 350 high school students tomorrow, so I'm very excited about that. There was a beautiful exhibition in the historical museum in Jatzlerz, and I imagine that I will meet the town brass tomorrow.
And one extraordinary story about your mother is that she fell in love in the camp, which seems almost unimaginable today when we think of the horrors going on, that here amidst all this horror, love could blossom.
Yes, and after they were separated and my mother ended up in Jatzlerz, he sent her a love letter, and the commandant of the camp called my mother in and said, "You're not supposed to get any letters here, but I've just read this letter, and it's so beautiful that I am going to give it to you." And that's how she got this last love letter from Harry.
I'm sending you the little photo from Gross Panyov. It is the most precious thing I own, because we were together then. How wonderful it would be if you were with me now. But every love has to be tested by suffering and separations, even though that is hardly necessary for us. You know very well that you can rely on me. My sweet little bride, I hope you still have some good opinions about men. However, please don't judge me by the usual standards, for there are no other girls for me, just one single beloved Salusia. My dearest, I wish you all the best for your birthday, and remain yours eternally, Harry.
When I go to work and look at the mountains, I think of you. Come, Harry, come to me. I'm so scared. Even though hundreds of kilometers are between us, nothing can separate us. You will always, always be mine. We thought it wouldn't come to this, but it has. And this is the cruelest. I don't even want to remember that moment, your tear-stained and drawn face. Oh, Harry, I ask you, tell me, when will all of this end?
And they both survived, both Harry, who was in fact a Czech Jewish fellow prisoner, and they both survived. He promised to marry her, but in fact he broke that promise, didn't he?
He did break that promise. After Harry was separated from my mother, he went on to another camp and another camp and another camp, and he had a girlfriend in every one of those camps. So he eventually met a young woman, and they were liberated together, and so he couldn't escape his promise. He actually did have to marry that last one.
And what happened to your mother after the liberation?
Well, when Harry sent her the telegram in Prague, which is where they had said that they would meet after the war, she was initially heartbroken, and then one of her friends saw her and practically slapped her and said, "Come on, Sala, there's a lot of men in this world." And they left Prague together, and they walked and rode along the tops of trains until they arrived at the American zone. And in the little town of Ansbach, Germany, in September 1945, my mother attended Jewish New Year services for the first time since she had left her mother and father in 1940. And there, the American soldiers from the nearby base at Nuremberg were also attending Jewish New Year services. So there was Sala Garnsash, you know, 90 pounds, sitting upstairs in the women's section, and there was Sidney Kirshner, corporal from New York City, sitting downstairs, and he found a way to get an introduction to her, and 2 months later they were engaged, and about 4 months after that she was on a boat to the United States as a war bride. They moved fast in those days.
And one result of that is you.
Yes.
And the book that you wrote, partly wrote, partly composed from the letters about your mother's story.
The book, Sala's Gift, weaves the letters together with the historical context. But the star of the book, if you will, is 16-year-old Sala being taken away from home and having to navigate the incredible hostile world of the war.
And your mother's still alive, and so what does 88-year-old Sala think of the book?
Sometimes she's very shy, very private, my mother, so sometimes she feels a little exposed. But then other times, I know she's happy that we're talking about people who were killed, people who otherwise would have left the world without a trace. And it is important that people remember. There are worse things than being 88 years old and having people talking about you. So I think she forgives me for making me tell her secrets. I suspect she has one or two that she hasn't told me yet. And who knows, maybe there's another book in that.
I was talking to Anne Kirshner about her book, Sala's Gift. The English edition was published by Simon & Schuster in 2006, and the Czech translation, Salin Dar, has just been published by Mladá Fronta. The translation came about on the initiative of the young Czech filmmaker Karin Venhauerová, who herself was born in Žatslář. In 2008, a small exhibition of Sala's correspondence was held in the town, and when Karin saw it, she was amazed that she had never heard about the wartime camp. She managed to get a grant to have the book published in Czech and is working on a documentary that will tell Sala's story. At the end of the book is a list of Sala's relatives. Of those who were in Poland at the beginning of the war, only Sala and two of her sisters, Reisel and Blima, survived, along with the 350 letters and a few photographs. "Do you know why I write so much?" Reisel wrote in a letter to Sala in April 1941. "Because as long as you read, we are together. And as long as we read, we can keep alive the memory of those who died."
David Vaughan there, as always, with that edition of Czech Books. If you're just tuning in, then thank you for joining us. You're listening to Radio Prague, the international service of Czech radio. My name's Christian Falvey, and now it's time for our monthly series, Science Journal. The American magazine Science is one of the world's leading publications for guess what topic, and getting your article in is no easy feat. A truly unique discovery being the main criterion. So it's always a happy occasion when Czech scientists can boast of their good work on its pages. The most recent of them is the team of Igor Jeks from the Czech Technical University in Prague, who told me more about their success in the field of quantum physics.
The article is about a so-called two-dimensional walk, and the originality essentially is as the even reviewer has pointed out, this is the first in the world experiment which is performing experimentally or demonstrates experimentally a walk in a plane, a quantum walk in a plane, meaning we we have a walker which is endowed with quantum properties, and this allows the spreading of a walker in a wave manner in a plane. So that's what the reviewers and the journal thought to be the most striking feature of the manuscript, which was accepted.
Now, quantum leaps are well known, but quantum walks less so. Can you describe in simple terms what exactly is happening on a quantum walk?
A classical walk we can imagine as a walker which just can go left and right, while a quantum walk is a walk where the walker can simultaneously take two or more paths or make two or more steps to different directions, while, as the quantum physicists say, keeping coherent. So you can imagine that as a wave which is keeping splitting and staying a wave. So when two paths meet, the pieces of the wave interfere very, very similarly to a wave on a surface of a lake. If you throw two stones, so you see an interference pattern.
And this is not purely described mathematically, but can also be experimented with.
Yeah, that's the striking feature. While the theoretical considerations been around for, say, several years, this is really the first experimental demonstration, not only of the walk on a line, but that it can be used to mimic other quantum systems. So this is the other striking feature, that we use the quantum walk in two dimensions to simulate interaction of two particles on a line. So you can imagine that a single walker in a plane, because it can go left, right, up, down, say, so this corresponds to decreasing the distance between two walkers, increase or both going left or both going right without changing their relative distance.
And this sounds very theoretical, but it actually can provide a lot of various applications. What kinds of applications could
it be? The applications are mainly from our point of view. So the immediate application is simulation of other quantum systems. Say when you want to study a system which is in a noisy environment and you want to just see the pure quantum effect, so some quantum processes we can mimic with our real system, so we can perform analogous experiment in a cleaner environment. Or what is our next goal is to use it for quantum information purposes. So we want to use the walk as a device which can realize certain algorithms which are expected from a quantum computer. So there comes then the analogy to a quantum computer. And the next step, what we want to take with our colleagues in Germany, is to perform a quantum search. A quantum search is an algorithm which outperforms a classical search. So if you go through, say, a list of numbers, and you have just a phone number, and you want to know whose phone number is it, so that's quite a difficult task. And this task can be performed more efficiently on a quantum computer. So we want to demonstrate this effect using a 2D quantum walk.
Dr. Igor Jeks there from the Czech Technical University in Prague. The secrets of the Antarctic are unfolding beneath the watchful eyes of Czech scientists from Masaryk University in Brno. 7 years ago, the university began laying the foundations of the Mendel Polar Station at the tip of the Antarctic Peninsula. And now they have moved to expand that research. Dr. Miloš Bartak has just returned from his 10th trip to the continent and leads the university's program there. I asked him first about what previous years had brought so far.
There are numerous long-term projects that have been running since the time of establishment of the base, and they are mainly focused on the prediction of the effects of elevated temperature on Antarctic vegetation. And in the early 2007, we installed several open-top chambers over the vegetation of James Ross Island, and we are trying to understand whether or not that increase in temperature would affect the acceleration in growth and development of vegetation cover. And just recently, we learned some indications that the process depends very intensively on the altitude of the place, while lowland, or let's say coastal areas, are enriched in vegetation growth. Those locations on mesas at the altitude of 350 meters, they don't exhibit such a high increase in vegetation growth.
And now you've decided to expand your research with several different projects. Can you tell me about them?
Yeah, just recently we've introduced three new lines. The first one is physiology of fish. There was one member of expedition crew who was interested in a number and species richness of parasites in internal organ of Antarctic fish, and her mission was quite successful. The second line was devoted to collection of lichen and soil samples, and the final goal is to analyze content of heavy metals in those samples, simply to answer the question whether or not there is any effect of a long-distance transfer of heavy metals ions from Europe, America, and the other continents. And the third line was a little bit medical, I'd say, because we increased a number of sampling of microbacterial biota inside in the building of Johann Gregor Mendel Station. And also we were interested in sterilization of fruits and vegetables that were delivered to the station for staff, simply to reduce number of microbial, let's say, contamination being delivered from outside to Antarctica.
How do you travel there? The Mendel Polar Station is on James Ross Island. How do you get there?
Yeah, traveling this year was a little bit complicated because from Europe and South America we went by a Chilean icebreaker, and it was pretty long way because we spent some 3 weeks on a sea, but finally we succeeded in landing at the James Ross Island. And the journey back was even more complicated because Argentinian station Marambia had some problems with supply of fuel for helicopters, so helicopters flight were reduced in numbers and only emergency could happen. And finally we had to stay at the island a couple of weeks more than we expected, but finally majority of the crew was delivered to Marambia, and recently majority of the crew is in the Czech Republic, while three guys are staying at Marambia station, Seymour Island.
You can keep up with the work of the Czech Antarctic team through their new magazine, Czech Polar Reports, the first issue of which came out this week. So much for this edition of Science Journal. Please tune in again next month. Now, as ever of a Saturday, it's time for another trip down memory lane, or rather through the halls of the Czech radio archives. Here's David Vaughan.
In the days immediately after the Soviet invasion in August 1968, staff at Czechoslovak Radio played a cat-and-mouse game with the occupying forces. At first, they managed to continue broadcasting directly from the radio headquarters, despite the presence of tanks outside. Again and again, they repeated the government and party leadership's appeal for calm. Above all, they stressed the message from the country's leaders that the occupation was unwanted and illegal. But the Soviets were already hard at work to silence the radio. The chairman of the Central Board for Communications, Karel Hoffmann, was a political hardliner, and in collaboration with the invaders, gave the order that all medium-wave transmitters be shut off. 35 years later, in 2003, Hoffmann was the only former communist functionary to go to prison for his role in helping the Soviet invasion. Despite his efforts, broadcasts continued.
Všechny vysílače, které však máme k dispozici, byly postupně vyřazeny z provozu.
All the transmitters which we had at our disposal have been gradually forced out of operation, and we do not even know how many of you, our listeners, can hear us. But we shall try to stay in touch with you, even though some of our phone lines are cut off, and since 2 in the morning, foreign aircraft have been circling above the Czechoslovak radio building. Once the radio building was occupied, radio staff went to great lengths to keep on the air, taking risks and improvising at every step. Dear listeners, we must now leave you as the army of occupation is on its way, but we hope that shortly we'll be able to start broadcasting again from another private apartment. In the following days, Radio Prague, which then as now served as the radio's international service, was to play a central role.
This is Radio Prague, Czechoslovakia, broadcasting continuously in English, French, German and Italian, as well as Czech, and bringing you late news bulletins and reports as we receive them of the situation here in occupied Czechoslovakia.
Radio Prague became the voice of free Czechoslovakia to the world, broadcasting through mobile transmitters, which ironically had originally been provided by the Soviets. It could be heard loud and clear throughout Europe.
We are transmitting in the 49-meter band on 6.055 megacycles. However, since this frequency is being jammed, please tune us in by turning slightly to the right or left of this position on your radio dial.
Radio Prague brought the latest developments almost literally as they happened.
I beg you to excuse any possible slips of the tongue, but I am translating straight from a slip of a Czech text. According to information of eyewitnesses, the chairman of the Czechoslovak government, Mr. Oldřich Černík, was taken in a Soviet armed transporting vehicle at about 17 hours this afternoon to an unknown destination.
On August the 27th, the father of the Prague Spring Reforms, Alexander Dubček, returned from his forced stay in Moscow, having been bullied into signing the so-called Moscow Protocol that legitimized the invasion. From that moment on, the days were numbered for free radio broadcasts from Czechoslovakia.
That was David Vaughan with From the Archives, wrapping up Radio Prague's English program for today. If you'd like to listen again or recommend the program to others, we are always on the internet for you. Simply turn to our website at radio.cz. We're always happy to discuss your questions and comments. You can write to us by email at english@radio.cz, on Facebook or Twitter under Radio Prague, or, of course, with a good old-fashioned letter to Vinohradská 12, 12099, Prague. From me, Christian Falvey, thanks for listening and nashledanou.
vous écoutez Radio